Sure enough. The Senate Public Safety Budget Division will come to order. Today is Wednesday, January 28th, 2009. And we have the budget presentations for what we think of as our smaller divisions that are part of our departments that report to this committee. And we're going to start today with the Department of Human Rights. Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, we have new budget books hot off the press, and the agenda for the day is on your inside pocket. And you're welcome to leave them with the staff at the end of every meeting, and if you want to take them with you, just make sure you bring them back. Anything before we start with the first presentation? Okay. Commissioner.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Velma Corbel. I'm the commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, and with me today is our deputy commissioner, James Kirkpatrick. And we are here today to answer any questions you might have about the budget, the proposed budget. This is the governor's budget. The Department of Human Rights has a general fund budget of $6.4 million a biennium. That is roughly a 24.7% decrease, as indicated in the cover letter there from our general fund appropriation from fiscal year 08-09. I don't have very much to say about the budget, except it is what it is. I can certainly fill you in on some of the effects of a budget decrease of this size. And if you would just indulge me, I can certainly go through and just mention some of those.
Please do.
This budget is actually a little bit more for us than the 24.7% decrease that's indicated in the letter, because you may recall that there was a decrease to our budget of about $150,000 right at the tail end of fiscal year 07. So that will result in about an $804,000 decrease overall from the beginning of fiscal year 08 through up to the new biennium 2010-2011. There is a handout that we provided for you that just lists some highlights of the effects of this decrease to the Human Rights Department. Caseloads per enforcement officer continue to go up. We've seen an increase in the case filings over the last several weeks. This same thing happened in 2003 when we went through this economic downturn. We expect that rise in case filings will increase and eventually plateau, but right now we've seen those case filings increase. Because of the case filings increase and that resultant decrease in staff, which this budget will effectively cause, we're looking at some other things related to the department's performance. Although we'll try to mitigate those as best we can, it just is a matter of fact that when your department is primarily labor and the work that we do is so labor-intensive, if we lose people, then the work changes, the work performance changes. For example, if we have a 365-day requirement to get cases done, right now we're doing that in about 320 days on average. We expect that will go up because the corresponding caseload per investigator will increase. We expect that we have a case inventory now that where we have no cases in the inventory that are over the 365-day time limit. It's just a matter of fact that when you have fewer people to get the work done, it is likely that inventory will increase. We saw this temporarily when we had some vacancies that went unfilled for a time, and it happens relatively quickly. When we have investigator positions go vacant, as the cases come in, there are fewer people to get those cases done, and so the inventory does increase. As soon as we get people back in the department and get them up to speed on doing the investigations, that inventory goes down rather rapidly. But if we move to a position where we have fewer staff and that is ongoing, it is very likely that inventory is going to increase. Right now, we are doing about 90 audits of state contractors who have affirmative action plans and certificates of compliance a year. again, that's very labor-intensive work if that is affected, and I fully expect it will be by a decrease to the budget. We can also expect that we'll have to change the number of audits that we do of state contractors. Also, the amount of outreach that we're able to do to parts of Minnesota other than just the metro area, because we won't have the travel budget, we won't have the people. And so there will be the service that we're able to provide the state of Minnesota will be affected. We're working now to try to do some things, collaboration, some partnerships with other state agencies and other organizations to minimize the negative effects as much as possible. But our story is no different than any other story. I mean, it will happen. The performance will change. But that's where we are. The budget is 6.4 for 2010-2011. We are here. I'm happy to take any questions.
Commissioner, it looks like the budget book says that you would lose 8 staff for 2010 and another 3, maybe another 2, a 2 and a part of a person?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
For 2011. You talked about everything would be taking longer and you would be like not doing as many audits. Are there other things that you're just not going to do? How are you going to?
Well, we have 3 primary areas of work that we do. Of course, we do the case investigations, the contract compliance programs, and our outreach program to other parts of Minnesota than the metro area. But we also do things like our Human Rights Day. We have we do some support for the League of Human Rights Commissions. They're the 40 nonprofit commissions across the state of Minnesota. We will have to change how we do work with these folks because we just won't have the people to sustain the level of engagement that we have in some of those things.
And then also, Commissioner, you got an unallotment at the end of the year. You referenced it about $300,000?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And what did that come from? Was that money left over from something that you thought you were going to do and decided not to do it, or... why were you with what pot of money was it that they got the $300,000 from?
Madam Chair and committee members, it came from a couple of places. It came from positions that we were holding vacant that we just were not going to fill because we anticipated that there might be a need to absorb a budget cut. But we also had money for a case management system, some technology to put in to track cases and a new database. And some of that was money that remained unspent from that project as well. So it came from a couple of different places. But I would like to point out, Madam Chair, that case management money that we were able to, where we were able to utilize a portion of that to absorb the unallotment, that is not there any longer as of the 2010 budget because the case management expense has happened. We've actually got the case management project in the building, and that is going to be live by the end of the spring. So that money is no longer available to us to do that.
And then, Commissioner, I know that many of the smaller agencies like yours got a 5% cut. Looked like you got a 10% cut.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm not aware of all of the percentage cuts of all of the agencies. I know there was a range of cuts for various agencies, but our cut was around 10%. That's correct.
All right. Questions from the committee? Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Thank you for coming here and discussing your concerns. If you are looking at what you have in the last biennium and what you expect to get, what's the difference?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, we would be down almost $1 million from the budget that we got back at the beginning of fiscal year 2008. So we've calculated it at around $804,000.
And Madam Chair, Commissioner, because of the human rights has kind of been been in a tough spot for a lot of years. What are you not doing that you can't do because of shortfalls in the funding?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, as I mentioned previously, the department has been required to get cases done within a certain amount of time. That has been extremely critical for the department since 1997 because, as the committee might recall, it was the legislature that put into place the performance standards for the department. And at that time, the legislature did provide the funding to be able to hire the staff and train the staff and employ the technology to be able to get that done. The concern that we have in the department is that that performance standard that was put in place by the legislature is not going to be met going forward. And more concerning than the performance standard for the legislature, there is a service level that we are not going to be able to provide to the residents of Minnesota. But that's all I can say that it is.
Chair,
Senator Foley.
This is a kind of situation where I know it's a serious dilemma and it's difficult to fund these things and somebody has to eat the cuts. But this agency just doesn't seem to me as one of those that we ought to be cutting very much. And while I'm not certain where I would take it or how we get into that, I really am interested in improving the funding of this agency so they can do an adequate job dealing with the human rights in the state of Minnesota and the employers and employees so that we have the proper coverage. Otherwise, it's useless to have an agency if we're not going to give them adequate resources mm-hmm. to deliver on.
You know, Senator Foley, I was struck during the unallotment period when people were talking about local government aid being cut, that one of the points that the governor was trying to make is that, you know, we know that local government has lots of money, you know, let's start looking at things like their human rights departments, you know, cities that have human rights departments. And I'm thinking, okay, seems to me that for a very long time, every year, our Department of Human Rights has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, but somehow the fact that other governments are taking up the slack for investigations and work in their jurisdictions is a bad thing. And I was just kind of struck about how just frankly silly that whole comment was. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, did you say that we stipulate by statute what your performance measure, what your performance goal has to be?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, the legislature did require in 97 through a special amendment that the department maintain a certain level of performance. And so since 97, we have provided reports to the legislature that describes the performance on every 6 months.
Senator Moore?
And Madam Chair, so Commissioner, obviously, if you are at this point doubting whether or not you'll be able to meet those performance levels, will the agency be submitting a bill as part of its agency bill to try to address that inability to meet those performance measures?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Watt, the performance standards are not codified in statute. They were the result of a legislative audit that was done of the department in 1997. And from that, the direction came down from a legislative committee that was formed to oversee the department at that time that we were to submit a performance report every 6 months, and so we've done that, but it is not codified in the statute.
Madam Chair,
Senator Moore.
So, Commissioner, so part of the reason why we have these performance measures in place is to make sure that when cases are brought to the department, that they get reviewed in a timely manner for a number of reasons, from a evidence perspective, from a procedural perspective. I read the reports that you submit to us because I'm interested in how we are expeditiously addressing that. So if we're not able to meet that, or if you're doubting our ability to meet that, aren't we doing a tremendous disservice if we're not able to meet that? And have you thought about internally what are ways that I guess you're going to have to come up with in order to address that?
Madam Chair, Senator Watt, we have thought about that. We've thought about it in terms of partnering with some of the local enforcement agencies. We're actually in conversations with those groups now in Minneapolis and St. Paul to try to do some partnering. But one of the things that we did in 2003, and we'll have to look at some work in this area, is we created a program back then called Docket and Dismiss, which was essentially creating a what we call the triage program for charges, and where the department has a very low threshold for the charges that we take in. We had to create a policy that we would get rid of charges a lot sooner, screen them, and dismiss them on the merits, so those charges did not get a full-fledged investigation, but it was what we were required to do in order to be able to give a charging party, for example, some screening of their allegations and the opportunity for a dismissal from the department so that they could move forward with their own attorney into court. And so we'll have to look at refining that to see where we can look at statutory definitions, new case law over the last 6 years to be able to do more of that. We'll see how we can partner with Minneapolis and St. Paul because they each have enforcement authority as well. We're looking at a lot of things. I mean, there right now, what I've said to my staff, and there just are no crazy ideas at this point because we're entertaining whatever we can entertain to make sure that we can mitigate any negative effects, and so that people who want to come to us for service are see as little disruption as possible.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, I first want to compliment the department for the work that they've been doing on the charges of discrimination and the investigations. From the information I've been receiving, it's clear that the department is working hard to understand the nature of the charges and to give them fair evaluations. One thing I am concerned along the lines of what Senator Moi raised was that category we're just going to dismiss on the merits because we don't have the resources to do any more with this case. Without necessarily passing judgment, not even getting to the point of not a finding of probable cause, not a finding of no probable cause, just a finding that we don't think there's enough here for us to do any further investigation. And that category may end up getting enlarged because by definition, you're not having the resources, it's going to be a bigger problem in the next 2 years than it has been in the last 2 years. And that would really short all of the employees that do have legitimate complaints about the way they were treated either in the workplace or in discharge from the workplace, and may or may not leave them with any recourse. Part of the problem is that even lawyers considering taking on these cases, they're making the same judgments. Is it worth the expenditure of their resources, as these are contingent fee cases, for free to determine if there is a meritorious case there? And the smaller cases that don't have great potential in terms of recovery are the cases the lawyers won't be able to afford to take either. The department may be the workers' only recourse to follow up. And so a dismissal on the merits that simply says you've got 45 days to sue it out doesn't help them. If the case is too small financially for a lawyer to take it on. So we're really leaving those aggrieved employees with no recourse if because of budget concerns we end up expanding that category of dismissal.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, it's a pleasure to talk to someone who understands the process at the Human Rights Department. Thank you for putting that out there. But it is it's a dilemma that we face since 2003, but we're doing the best we can with what we get every year or every 2 years.
Commissioner, remind us, what was your budget and how many staff, more or less, did you have going into the 2003 budget? You know, that was the last time we had a big honking budget deficit.
Madam Chair, committee members, at the beginning of 2003, and I'm going from memory here, our budget was about $8.4 million a biennium, and we were carrying at that time about 55 employees. And by comparison, going into 2010, we would be at the $6.4 million for the biennium, and we would start the fiscal year with about 35 employees.
There's a certain point at which doing more with less becomes doing less with less, doesn't it? Commissioner, one question. Does your department get any federal funds that we would lose because of the cuts that we're making here?
Madam Chair.
Proposed to be making?
Madam Chair, committee members, we do have a work share agreement with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is about $500,000 of biennium. And that money does not go back directly to the department. It actually goes into the general fund. And so there may be a there could be some effect to that, because those cases that were being contracted to do for the EEOC at $550 a case are also part of the inventory of cases that we just do in general. So we get $550 per case for every case that is jurisdictional under both the federal law under Title VII and also under the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
Okay.
But that money goes to the general fund, as I said.
And then comes back to you per case?
No, it goes into the general fund, Madam Chair.
And goes to education or something?
Madam Chair, I don't know where it goes. It goes into the general fund.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Kirkpatrick. Any comments? You've sat there so quietly.
It is what it is, ma'am.
Thank you both. I'm sure we'll be talking to you quite a bit in the next few months.
Madam Chair.
Let's see. The next department is the Post Board. Is Mr. Melton around? He is indeed. Welcome back to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Neil Melton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, better known as Post Board. Per our earlier conversation, Madam Chair, I'm going to do my comments in two components. We're going to talk about a review of what the Post Board is and what the Post Board does, and use a manner of a modified zero-based budget to create an agency. If this committee was given that task today, how would we replicate the Post Board today? And secondly, I will talk about the impact of the governor's recommendations. You have in your packet, or with you, a handout packet, 5 pages to augment, accent what I'm going to say. I think that should be in front of you. A little bit of background. In 1978, Minnesota became the first state in the nation to break away from the traditional paramilitary police academies and use college-based education programs to prepare peace officers. As part of that legislation in 1977, the enabling legislation, they created the mission of the Post Board, which was to, quote, enhance the profession of law enforcement in Minnesota through the selection, education, licensing, and regulation of peace officers. So for over 30 years, we have prepared what we consider to be the best educated and most professional law enforcement officers in the nation. These reflect 10,000-plus officers working in any of the 468 state, county, or local departments. These officers have set the standard to which other states aspire, and is evidenced by the number of requests we get from other states to come here and recruit our candidates and our peace officers. The Post Board exists to ensure Minnesota maintains that high level of professionalism. And to understand how Post completes that mandate, I call your attention to the first handout I gave you, which is called Activities and Accomplishments. If you'll notice, I've probably got 20 of them listed. We're talking about action verbs. This is what the Post Board does. This is why we exist. It is a working, busy agency. We award licenses. We administer exams. We renew licenses annually. We manage college programs. We recertify college programs. We open allegations of misconduct for officers as well as impartial policing complaints. We processed, in the 2 years I've described, in 07 and 08, 24 complaint committee actions, 8 automatic license revocations. We do on-site visits to law enforcement agencies. That is, my staff goes out and sits down with the chief or sheriff or state agency director to discuss their policies and procedures. We do background checks for officers being hired. We did over 3,300 in that biennium. We also processed over 300 federal applications for permits to carry for retired officers. And my staff and I, we attended conferences in-state and out-state to better explain the role and functions of the Post Board. I think you'll agree from the list that Post serves as both a regulator and a resource to our stakeholders. Now, being a regulator is fairly easy. It's defined in statute, it's clear, it's concise, it's black and white, we follow the rules. Being a resource is a bit more difficult. It requires critical thinking skills and the ability to work with law enforcement, with all of our stakeholders, to create a better law enforcement community. So if we created an agency to fulfill those tasks, what type of positions would we need? We're starting out day one with a brand new agency. I've listed these in a specific order, and there is another handout that shows the Post staff. First, I would call upon a pre-service education coordinator. In my speeches and comments around the state, I always reference that Minnesota's law enforcement begins in a college classroom. We have an incredibly talented group of colleges and college faculty members, 23 colleges in the state, two-year, four-year, public and private, that provide part of this professional education program. We need a pre-service education coordinator to visit the campuses to ensure they are in compliance with the rules that the legislature has set forth on learning objectives for entry-level officers. Secondly, I would hire a testing and licensing coordinator, because the people have come out of the courses, they're ready to be peace officers, we have to give them an exam, and hopefully they pass. In the last few years, 90% of our candidates do pass the exam coming out of the colleges. We'll test about 1,100 a year. We will license about 650. The testing coordinator also is in charge of the licensing renewal cycle, and that licensing renewal is not just for peace officers. It's also for part-time officers, military reciprocity candidates, as well as interstate reciprocity, officers wanting to come to Minnesota from other states. After I had those two positions filled, I'd hire a continuing education coordinator. In Minnesota, education does not end when they get their degree, nor when they get their peace officer licenses. The legislature has mandated certain educational requirements to keep a peace officer's license. The two primary training requirements are use of force, as well as pursuits and emergency vehicle operations. And you have put those in statute, and we monitor that that does actually occur. So my education coordinator would go out and meet with the vendors and the providers of this education to ensure that they are keeping into the spirit and intent of what the legislature created for those training mandates. Then I'd hire two standards coordinators. In fact, I have two on staff. They're retired peace officers. It is their job to travel around the state. We fire up the Post Board Winnebago, or we stay in Motel 6s all over the state, and we visit police departments. We get into their training records as well as their personnel records, and we ask them to prove to us that the officers do, in fact, have this education, have this training, show us that they conducted the state-required background checks, of criminal history checks, medical, psychological, and so forth, as well as responding to allegations of misconduct and citizen complaints. The two standards coordinators I would hire would have extreme patience, but have a detective's mind when they're solving complaint issues. Once I had those people on staff, I'd hire a legislative and rules coordinator. This person is not a lobbyist. This person helps Post Board develop, analyze, and implement administrative rules, as well as interpret legislative initiatives. This person serves in my capacity when I get double and triple booked at different functions seminars. This person would spend time at the Capitol getting to know the legislators and understanding not only what they're introducing, but why they're doing it. Then I would hire an information technology specialist. Like most state regulatory agencies, we live and die, succeed and fail, by our ability to control, manipulate, disperse, and analyze data. And we have tons of it. This person is responsible for all of our licensing, pre-service and in-service, all of the exam statistics, all the demographic information that comes out, as well as our web-based or our website. And the newest initiative that POST is involved in is the online e-licensing initiative from the state of Minnesota. We're the first agency in the state to sign on with OET, Office of Enterprise Technology, in that environment. Our information technology specialist is absolutely critical. This person literally has the keys to the kingdom. Next, I need some support staff. And currently, I would hire four. We have four people who do all the duties from reception to data entry to customer service, constituent services. We generate a lot of activity when we renew 4,000 peace officer licenses a year and handle all of the other inquiries that come in. Last but not least, I'd hire an executive director. And last but not least, that is my position. I am the voice and the face of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training. My job is to get out and sell this organization, explain what it is we do, but to also analyze and interpret laws. I have to handle the fiscal component of the POST Board, manage the affairs of the board, and serve in a capacity of saying, POST is a resource to this state. My job is to tell people, having the POST Board makes us unique among the states and the nation. Nobody else has what we have or does what we do. The positions I just described are 12 FTEs. Those 12 reflect a 20% decrease in FTEs from 2001. We used to have 15 staff. Now, moving on to building the agency from scratch, staffing and personnel takes the lion's share of our operating budget. Other expenditures are routine and certainly expected. We have office space, classrooms to administer the exams, workstations, computers, communications, staff development. But I think one of the most important components of our operating budget is that no member of my staff, including me, have traveled out of state in 10 years. I was the last person from the POST Board to travel to an out-of-state conference. That was in 1999. Rather, I communicate with my POST colleagues from the other 49 states by emails and telephone calls. It's not the best system, but I prefer to use our limited travel dollars for in-state, as our coordinators travel to colleges, police departments, community groups. If we can get three people to stand still long enough, we're going to talk to them about the POST Board, and I think those dollars are better spent on in-state travel. Next, you have a handout of the POST Board members. People ask me, is there actually a board? Well, there actually is a board. There are 15 members, and they are appointed by the governor to four-year staggered terms. As indicated on your handout, we have the superintendent of the BCA. That's the only ex officio member. That means whoever sits in that chair is a member of the POST Board. They are the only member also who can send a designee. We have two police chiefs, two sheriffs, three peace officers, one state trooper. These are all defined in statute. Two former peace officers who are current faculty members at the colleges, one college administrator, two public members. And my favorite is, this is very specific. We have one elected city official from a statutory or home rule charter city of an under 5,000 population outside the metro area. So we're very specific what we want this elected official to be. Next, we're going to move to the budget, and this is also in your budget book. As described, you've got a pie chart in front of you. Our budget code has four major components. Number one is the training reimbursement, $3.5 million. It amounts to 75% of our expenditures. These monies are collected from two sources. Number one, the surcharge on certain criminal and traffic offenses, of which POST is allocated or authorized 39%, but actually our real figure is set by the legislature. Currently at about 25%. We have $1.1 million in general operating, $3,000 in board expenses, and $1,000 for a U.S. bank e-licensing fee for that new online system. I think what I'd like you to take away from this chart is that over 75% of the money the Post Board receives is distributed back to local units of government to help offset the training costs for police. Next, the governor's recommendations. I believe this is number four in your agency overview, but I draw your attention to the columns for 09 and 10 and 11. You'll see that our total budget was actually decreased in 10 and 11. But that's not really accurate. It does not show an accurate decrease, because what Post did in 09 was carry forward $25,000 from FY08. So in essence, our budget was unchanged. However, there is a reduction in our full-time equivalent positions. This year, FY09, we are authorized 12.2 full-time equivalent positions, and as you could tell from the earlier chart, we have 12. We are now going to be at 11.7 in FY010 and 11.3 in FY11. I certainly do anticipate, if that continues, that we will have another staff layoff sometime in calendar year 2010. And again, as I mentioned, we have already been reduced, but we have made up a lot in efficiencies with our computer system. Before I go on and answer questions, I want to share a couple of thoughts about why Post performs such a unique system. One of the basic functions of state government is to regulate the various professions to protect the health and safety and welfare of citizens. Underlying that belief is that regulation improves the level of service. A regulatory component is easy. We follow the laws and we sanction officers or agencies that are not in compliance. But then we work as a resource. We want voluntary compliance. That is, if we can help you be in compliance with state laws, we will help the agencies, the officers, the citizens, anybody who lives in, visits, or simply drives through the state of Minnesota. But we're never satisfied. We are an evolving agency. We are a growing agency. You will see us bring a few initiatives forward this year in a variety of areas, all with the purpose of improving Minnesota's law enforcement. Any questions, members of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Melton. Any members of the committee have questions? Senator Foley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melton, one of the issues that has arisen and is likely to continue to be a problem is the administrative actions that the cities, some of the cities, have taken in order to avoid the criminal justice system. Have you reached a point where you're underfunded because the money that they have taken off from the funds that essentially the same source that you're using, the monies from fines and so forth?
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley,
No,
at this point, the reduction in citations has resulted in a decrease in the surcharge, but for now that's posed more of a deficit in the general fund than it is with our money, because anything not taken from Post out of that surcharge is credited to the general fund. Our budget has stayed fairly level. The per-officer training share has gone down a little bit. We're monitoring that very closely.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Melton, when you look at that diversion of funds, and all I can say is from the data that I have, is that that's an increasing thing, and that while you may not have reached a level where it's impacted your funding, that it has that prospect of doing that. And what do you propose to do when that happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley.
Mr. Melton.
Very timely question. Last week, the Post Board met and voted to oppose the language that would allow towns to use administrative citations, and for a number of reasons. Number one, if there's a uniform citation from the state, it should be uniform across the state. We're concerned that varying fees and fines are all over the state. You can drive down the same highway, be stopped by three different agencies, and get three different citations for the same offense. There, we think that lacks, doesn't reflect well for our professionalism, so to speak. We don't want our peace officers to be revenue generators for the town. We are going to oppose that legislation to hopefully stem that reduction in that surcharge, but not for a monetary reason, out of more of a professional standards reason.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
Mr. Melton. What is the... Because I know a variety of people have looked at this, the state auditor and the legislative auditor and the attorney general, and some have seen this more often, and the fund is growing, but nobody seems to want to deal with the issue that we're talking about. And your position now is that this post board has moving away from the use of this or seeking to do so. Does the governor have a position on this?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Melton,
and Senator Foley, I am not aware of the governor's position today. I don't know. We've had these discussions for about 3 years. And certainly since the surcharge went from $25 to $75, or $76 if you live in Ramsey County, it's becoming, well, anecdotally, it's harder for officers to write tickets if the fines are so high. It's not necessarily the fine, it's the surcharge. So one of two things has to happen. The surcharge has to go down, or officers have to, or aren't going to write the tickets, perhaps. Post Board has argued both sides of this for 2 or 3 years. And it is, my staff and I spend a lot of time discussing this. And the chiefs and sheriffs on one side, currently the post board is on the other. And we'll see how this plays out. But we've got meetings. My staff and I will meet with the legislators. There is no clear-cut answer.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
Mr. Melton, I think there's going to be a solution this legislative session. I've had legislation in past sessions. There's a reluctance to do something with minor traffic offenders that has driven this difficulty in overturning it. The actual statute is in my mind, indicates that what cities are doing is unlawful, but we haven't got anyone in the Attorney General office or whoever would take and bring a order of mandamus at least and seek the money to be diverted back to where the legislative intent was sitting there. I only speak on this because I was one of the founders of the board and used to teach in classes, and Donald Moe was a senator that drove the formation of this. And you're right, you are one of a unique group of people in the United States, and while I wouldn't agree with everything that you do, you do a good job, and I hope that that we can continue to fund this at the level that you need in order to provide the training to the peace officers in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator.
On that particular issue, Mr. Melton, I know this is an entirely predictable quandary that the state and the local governments are finding themselves in now when the traffic surcharge was increased. And Hennepin County is now $78. Mm-hmm. And hearing officers that deal with these in Hennepin County all the time are in a horrible position. What they end up doing is they cut the fine down to $25 or less, which reduces the income to or the revenue to all of the places where the fine gets distributed, including the courts and including the local governments. But that surcharge is still added on, which they can't do anything about, and that sends money directly to the state. And so if a police officer stops someone for going 5 miles over the limit because they're running a traffic patrol in some area and they've had some history of people, they don't want to make someone pay $100 because they were driving 5 miles over the limit. And that's why they're letting them go, not writing the tickets, or why the local governments are doing administrative citations. And as we look at cutting the judicial budget even further, I think the governor's proposal was about a 10% cut in the judiciary in terms of funding. Maybe it's more than that. And the courts are going to be struggling for ways to reduce their workload. They're going to do even less traffic enforcement cases. They're going to put them all on hearing officers. They're going to make them all payables. They're going to find other ways. It's simply going to say, you know, we're not going to deal with these anymore because they're not going to have the people to deal with them. It is a quandary we've kind of created ourselves when that traffic surcharge was raised to such an incredible level. But I have another question in that regard, which is, how do other states handle the functions that the Post Board handles in Minnesota? If we're relatively unique in the scope of how we do that, where are the other states handling the training of their officers and the licensing and so on?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Melton.
Oh, you're back.
Oh, I'm back.
Most of the other states certify their officers. That is, they're not licensed. And licensing in Minnesota is very unique. You may work for Minneapolis or the State Patrol or Beltrami County Sheriff's, but that's an employment relationship. The state of Minnesota has your license, and we have certain purviews over you because of that license. So we have, I believe, an incredible system of checks and balances and oversight and regulation that other states do not have. The other states do it on a local jurisdictional basis because you're certified by the state. They granted you the license or this certificate to be a peace officer. But now you're governed by local politics, not an overriding state umbrella of professionalism. And the other states also are primarily academic or academy-oriented training, paramilitary. We train our officers in a college setting.
Madam Chair?
Senator Latz.
I raise the question only because we're in such a tight budget situation. I think we at least need to discuss alternative ways of delivering the services that the state delivers in all areas, and this is a committee that we're in, and I think we have to consider how to handle that. I mean, the discussion came up about human rights and local human rights agencies and whether there's a duplication of delivery or whether there's pushing off of responsibility in that regard. I think it's fair to have the discussion as well. If most other states do their peace officer certification or oversight in other ways, we think we need to at least be aware of that and consider whether that's something we ought to look at when we're dealing with the budget that we are. I'm not proposing anything. I'm only raising it for intellectual discussion at this point. But
Madam
it
Chair,
has to be on the table like everything does.
I suppose.
Madam Chair, if I may respond to a couple of the comments.
Sure.
And thank you, Senator Lamb. Other states talk to me all the time trying to figure out how we did this. But the mindset was, and the wisdom back in the late 70s, to create something like this. I just had a long talk with my colleague or my the same job in Texas. They would love to have our system. They've got a series of just little pockets of fiefdoms, and there's arguments, and there's no statewide professionalism. So I am very proud when I talk to my counterparts in the other states about what we've got.
Senator Waugh?
Well, Madam Chair, it seems that I recall that a lot of the issues that we just talked about with respect to the fines and the fees and the surcharges were part of the judiciary's attempt to do our part to solve the budget deficits in 2003 and then in 2005. And in essence, what we did was we did allow a number of different fees to be increased, a number of court fees to be increased, a number of surcharges to be put on a number of judiciary tickets, court procedures. And then because we were trying to do our part, we sort of didn't keep track of how we were raising all this money. It went to the general fund, the way the money in the human rights department is also going to general fund. And we're finding that we are doing our part, I think, as the judiciary to raise a lot of money that went to general fund. And yet we were still taking a pretty big hit as a budget division. So it's just interesting, you know, that we are now yet at another juncture where I think we're going to be asked to do our part. And while I frankly don't think there are any more fees that we could raise or any more surcharge. In fact, what we're hearing is that the surcharge that we put in place is exactly why we have these other issues to deal with. And now we're going to cut. And so I'm very interested to see as we move forward how much more we could do our part to continue to cut, because we've done, I think, our part to raise the revenues in 2003 and 2005.
Senator Wyle, it'll be a good day when we undo a bunch of those surcharges and fees, and I don't know when that might be.
Well, Madam Chair, I have a bill,
oh.
And it was drafted, and it was introduced. And I was trying to be respectful, because in this current climate, I think if I were to introduce that bill, even though I'm very serious about it, some individuals might perceive it as trying to be cute and disrespectful. But I did have the bill drafted, and I think that at some point when things do get better, I know that I have plenty of partners in this committee and other committees to help look at that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ryan. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wyle, you might consider who pays the cost of training, that in the overall scheme, you look at police officers when this legislation establishing a post board was brought forward, why police officers didn't get a very good salary, and the thing was, oh, but now it's a different sort of thing.
Yeah.
Police officers do fairly well financially, and you might think that they could pay their own tuition, that we don't pay doctors, nurses, lawyers, and others to get their education.
We repay some of them, though. I'm sorry, I stepped out. Had you completed your presentation, Mr. Melton?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Letts.
Just along the same lines, just highlight one example, Senator Moyle's point. You know, we raised the reinstatement fee for DWI license revocations from I think it's $200-some to now it's $680, plus the application fee for the new license. And what has happened is it resulted, number one, in the bill that we passed last year for those who are eligible for public defenders to split that cost over 2 years. But most of the time what happens is people who can't afford to pay it, they don't pay it. They just drive without getting reinstated, which increases all sorts of costs and problems in the system. So, I mean, at some point, we're at the point now where we are realizing the serious negative side effects of fees that are just too high.
I think you're exactly right. Thank you, Mr. Melton. I'm sure we'll be talking to you soon. All right. Sentencing Guidelines Commission is next, and I know they have to put the computer on and all of that. Members, let me point out one of the pieces of paper in your pile of handouts is from the Department of Corrections, and they provided some answers to questions that we had asked at one of our last hearings, having to do with the number of inmates who have a mental illness or a dual diagnosis and the number of offenders who refuse treatment. And you're welcome to tuck that into your budget book or into the save folder if you want to hold that for others. It was on the same pile of paper that you got the post board and this other blue thingy. Looks Look there. It's ready to go. All right. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission, we have Mr. Ed Blad, who's the chair of the commission, and Suzanne, is it just Allegro?
Allegro, that's
Allegro,
correct.
Allegro, the executive director. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jeff Edblad. I am the Isanti County Attorney and Chair of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And I'm proud of the role that Minnesota has played at both the national level and the international level at being a leader in the area of sentencing guidelines. We've been a leader at the national level through the creation of the sentencing guidelines in 1978, being the first state to do so. And our guidelines were a model for the state of Washington, which followed closely thereafter in 1984. More recently, we've been national leaders in the area of sentencing departures. We were the first Sentencing Guidelines Commission in 2004 to come up with a response for states on how to deal with the Blakely versus Washington decision. We had a recommendation on the governor's desk while other sentencing guidelines states were still setting up their committees on dealing with the issue. We were a leader in the implementation of a sex offender sentencing grid, and we've been a leader internationally in that during the last 12-month period, we've been dealing with representatives from the United Kingdom who have recommended a sentencing model for Great Britain and Wales based upon the Minnesota sentencing guidelines, as well as representatives from South Korea who are looking at using our guidelines as a model for offenses such as sex offenses and robberies. I'm proud of the role that we've played with regard to the public and our various constituent groups, and that we've provided an honest front-end account of sentences that actually were to be served. I'm proud of the role that we've played with our constituent groups, such as the legislature, in the data that we've collected, maintained, and disseminated on every felony punishment so that sentencing trends can be accurately described, accurately predicted, and the impact can be dealt with on resources such as prison bed funding. I'm proud of the goals that we've met in the assurance of public safety, providing uniformity and consistency in felony sentences, that we've provided certainty through the concept of truth in sentencing for offenders as well as their victims, and proud of the role that we've played in making sure that sentences are proportional.
Ms. Allegra.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As Mr. Ed Blad mentioned, in 1978, Minnesota created the first Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Minnesota then became the first state to adapt a sentencing guidelines system, and that became effective for offenses committed on or after May 1, 1980. Since that time, 20 states and the District of Columbia have some sort of sentencing guidelines system. In 1981, when the guidelines went into effect, 5,500 felons were sentenced compared to 16,168 in 2007. Over the years, sentence lengths have increased and guidelines have become more complex due to statutory enhancements and mandatory minimums. We have included in your packet a list of the statutory enhancements from 1987 through 2008. During the years, the Guidelines Commission has felt that there's been a benefit that from periodic assessment. And in one of these assessments, they recognized the unique nature of sex offenders and so created a separate grid for sex offenses, which was effective on or after August 1st of 2006. This slide shows the increase in the number of offender sentence for felony convictions from 1981 through 2007. I will point out that 2007 is the first year where the number of felon sentence declined. There was a 1.7% decrease. This was the first decline since 2000. As you're probably aware, there was quite a bit of growth between 2001 and 2004, and this was due mainly to felony DWI and drug offenses, mainly meth. Both of these offenses appear to have leveled off. As Mr. Ed Blad had mentioned, there are four basic goals of the sentencing guidelines: to assure public safety, promote uniformity, to provide truth and certainty in sentencing, and to establish proportionality. In 2008, the National Center for State Courts performed the first ever comprehensive and comparative evaluations of states that had sentencing guidelines to see if, in fact, they did achieve the purpose for which they were set up. The study compared guideline structure in Minnesota, Michigan, and Virginia. The conclusion was that Minnesota guidelines offer higher predictability due to a complex set of elements used to determine criminal history, as well as comparatively narrow guidelines. The researchers found that this was in contrast to the inconsistent pattern that existed prior to implementation as to who went to prison and for how long. The report also indicated that guidelines make sentencing more transparent and limited undesirable sentencing disparity by reducing race and economic status. Low incarceration rates also reflect one of the key principles of the sentencing guidelines. And the Commission has realized that due to limited correction resources and the fact that the least restrictive punishment should be used to achieve the purpose of the sentencing. In 2005, the Bureau of Justice Statistics determined that Minnesota incarceration rate was the second lowest in the nation. They performed this study looking at the number of inmates per 100,000 residents. Minnesota had 300 per 100,000 residents. The only state lower was Maine with 273. The highest was Louisiana with 1,138. And on average, most states, the average was 750. As Mr. Edblad also mentioned, Minnesota has been used as a model of best practices. He mentioned the Great Britain's coming to visit us. In addition, South Korea plans to implement guidelines patterned after Minnesota for sex offenses and robbery. And also, following Minnesota's lead, Iowa and Connecticut now analyze the impact of the racial impact of proposed crime legislation. We've included some of our activities or benchmarks for you. As I'd indicated before, we have collected sentencing data on all felony convictions from 1980 to present. Over 16,000 were sentenced in 2007, so as you can see, we have quite an extensive database. We trained over 1,000 practitioners, answered over 50 data requests, and 2,500 phone calls. We respond to fiscal requests from proposed legislation as well as racial impact analysis. We collaborate with the Department of Corrections on prison bed projections. We rank new felony offenses, consider changes made from existing crimes and sentencing provisions, and respond to sentencing issues that arise from case law. We publish yearly guidelines, sentencing trends, and mandated legislative reports, and we have included, again in your packet, a list of all the reports we've produced. Given the vast amount of data that we deal with, we have concentrated on the use of technology in order to improve our effectiveness. We've collaborated with other state agencies, and two examples are we're working on a new method to retrieve data from the Minnesota Court Information System. Once this is functional, which will be this year, it will replace the current practice of manual data entry, thereby reducing the amount of time it takes to report annual sentencing statistics. Additionally, we're working with the Department of Corrections to improve on quality data checks, upgraded technology, and integrated data. Regarding our budget, our biennial budget is $1,218,000. Of that, the personnel costs are $1,032,000, and operating expenses are $186,000. We currently have a complement of 6.75 FTEs. In 2008, we did have a staff reduction of one position, which reduced our complement 13%, and we needed to do this in order to absorb salary and operating cost increase. I provided a slide that shows, similar to other agencies, our operating expenses: space rental, communications, copier lease and maintenance, in-state travel, professional service contracts, and supplies. We received from the governor his budget reflects a 5% decrease or $60,000 over the biennium. What we are looking at in order to avoid further layoffs, because as I indicated, we already have cut a position, is to look at these following options. We're looking at relocating our office from current rental space to a state office building. We have started this process several weeks ago, and we think we can accomplish this before the end of June. We're also in the process of looking at how we can reduce in-state travel expenses for training by changing over to web-based tools. We're also looking at reviewing alternatives for other operating expense reductions, such as purchase of equipment versus lease, and if we can get together with other agencies to perform our functions. And additionally, we're looking at ways to examine how we can streamline our agency reports and further research. Although in the reports that we do produce, I think the staff's felt that these are requests that we get from practitioners most often, and it's more effective to produce the reports on a yearly basis rather than doing it each time we receive a request.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you're talking about costs and you got something in there in the Centennial Building, I was surprised there's a rental fee for that. What does that cost your department to locate in the Centennial?
Ms. Allegra?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, any of the state buildings, you do pay a fee for those, as they need to provide certain services when you occupy the space. So what we're looking at, it would be cheaper to go into a state building as opposed to stay in lease space, but there is a cost to being in a state facility.
Sure. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard that you had to have a reduction in staff, was it last year? But at the same time, you stated that, was that an allowance in order to have pay increases go up? It was absorbed through that loss? An adjustment made?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, it was my understanding. I was not here at the time. I've been in the position about a month. But it was my understanding, in order to pay for other salary costs and that type of thing, that they did need to eliminate a position in order to keep the staff, the staff fully funded.
Yeah, well, Madam Chair, so did you have a reduction in your budget that created this type of move for personnel, or were you just held harmless, and instead of being held harmless, you moved the salary up of all but one person, and then that one person was dismissed?
Ms. Allegra?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's my understanding, in order to keep the budget at the level it was set at and to pay all the expenses, yes, that they did need to eliminate a position in order to keep, as I say, increases that may have occurred due to salary step increases or due to any operating cost increases.
Okay. And Madam Chair, Senator, was that the ability to raise someone's salary due an increase, is that a requirement given to you by law, or is that up to the department to use its own discretion on how to handle pay increases in light of budget restrictions?
Ms. Allegra?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's my understanding that if any of the salary increases were given, they were step increases that the person would have received as part of a normal progression in the position they were in.
And Madam Chair, I'm trying to learn how the state works. It seems like some departments work in different, they're not a universal approach to how they handle this. If there were step increases, I'm assuming those are kind of automatic type increases that are kind of assumed. I'm not sure, is that a legal requirement that you're following for the step increases, or was this a discretionary decision to lay off one person while everyone else got the pay increase?
Ms. Allegro?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's my understanding that certain of the employees would be entitled to I'd say a legal requirement. I would assume it's part of the pay plan. And what had happened is they let somebody, they didn't, I misspoke if I said layoff, they let the person that we, the position we didn't fill, the person was not performing the way they should have, so they let the person go. And then, given the other concerns they had about the budget, they decided not to fill the position. And at that point, the position was basically gone.
Madam Chair, did the department have a choice to perhaps, instead of recognizing these step increases, that instead of that, you could have maintained the full complement of staff, and perhaps no one getting an annual increase as an alternative?
Ms. Allegro?
Madam Chair, Senator, I was not here when the decision was made. I'm just, it had occurred prior to my getting there, but that was my understanding as to what had happened in order to live within the budget and provide any increases that had happened. They needed to cut down the complement.
Senator Limmer, suspect that it's part of the union contract that has to be fulfilled.
Yeah. Is that how it works?
I think that's how that works.
So, Madam Chair, what you're saying is the union, through its negotiation process, has agreed with the administration that in the event there's a decrease in a budget or not enough money as before, instead of holding everyone to a current pay scale, they'll jettison off perhaps the lowest one on seniority. Is that how it works?
Senator Limmer, I believe that each agency has obligations under the contract, mm-hmm. and you know, if they aren't able to find enough savings in other ways, that's probably one of the decisions they have to make.
Yeah.
You know, you can only get a crummier copier at a better rate, you know, so often, and I don't think you can pay for a salary that way.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what kind of savings will be mm-hmm. garnered from moving to Centennial, but I'm not sure it's enough to make up 5% of this department's budget.
Yeah,
Madam Chair, those are the kind of decisions we're asking folks to make.
This department's a small department, and so it doesn't have the scale to mm-hmm. absorb other losses in expected revenue. I'm just thinking, though, that there's at least one former state employee that it was a major issue for. And everyone else could have maybe just held on to their past salary without a small increase, and at least everyone could have shared the pain equally. And apparently, due to a previous collective bargaining agreement, I guess that's the rules of the game. That's how it was decided, and everyone agreed on that.
Mm-hmm.
I personally think it's well, I won't even get there. I won't even go there because it's an opinion of mine regarding contracts and unions and the association of a brotherhood of people working for a common cause, and yet they seem to jettison some of their lowest senior members in order to everyone else to gain.
Well, everybody's getting to make some really tough decisions,
yeah.
and it's only going to get worse. Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to convey to Senator Limmer that we do have the PELRA, which deals with the public employees' labor relations, mm-hmm. and what you're talking about here is that they had to solve and give this roll up on the salary, irrespective of the impact it might have on other members, and it's conceivable that, as you indicated, that they might not be able to retain a person because all the others got a pay raise.
Yeah.
Your agency is getting a 5% a proposed cut. We really rely on your agency a lot. I see in the bullets that are in the budget book that we asked you for twice as many fiscal notes last year
right.
as the previous year. And, of course, we want them in about a hot minute,
right.
you know. So we really do rely on you as a legislature for information and guidance and reports. We often ask you to do a report, and then we don't give you any money to do it. That's one of my favorite things.
Right.
I particularly like that one. I've done it several times. Thank you for all that you have done, and we will try to figure out as we go through the budget process whether there's other things that we can do, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you soon. And if you come up with ideas, would you let us know about the proposed move?
Yes, ma'am.
And anything else that comes up that could enter into our decisions. And we've got a few months here. We'll
okay.
figure something out.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Ms. Oman from the Private Detective Board.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marie Oman. I'm the Executive Director of the Private Detective and Protective Agent Services Board.
Thank you for coming today.
Thank you. I'd like to give a brief overview of our activities for the benefit of any new members and as a refreshment to continuing members of the committee. I'd like to provide an overview of the activities of our board. The board is a fee-driven agency, and those fees are deposited directly into the general fund from which the board receives an appropriation from the legislature to provide for its operating budget. We have five board members who represent public law enforcement, the industry's licensed, as well as the public. The board meets on a monthly basis to conduct their primary business, which is to review license applicants and license reissuance candidates and to approve training providers. A primary duty is that they have is to review those new candidates for licensing and those wishing to continue in the business for security investigative services in Minnesota. They ensure compliance with licensing requirements and respond to complaints and ensure compliance with mandatory training. The board manages over 300 license holders of private investigative and protective agent services. The board also manages roughly 80 training providers that represent more than 700 approved training courses, and those would be those of initial training for security officers, continuing training for security officers, for example, as well as armed training, both initial and continuing. The board has also engaged the license holder community in that training approval process, allowing the industry to share its expertise and its commitment to sound practices. Some of the services that these license holders do provide can be seen in our communities in the areas of uniform guard and patrol services, armored car services, event security, executive protection, corporate investigations, pre-employment and employment investigations, as well as insurance fraud investigations. Many of these services have become increasingly visible to the public, and those are such areas as in shopping malls and business complexes, corporate office facilities, airports, government buildings, and nuclear power plants. They're engaging in providing services that affect issues such as fraud and theft and its impact on the economy. Several thousand people are employees of these licensed services for which we monitor the completion of criminal history record checks, issuance of identification, and compliance with training. These services provide a key component to support government public safety efforts. The ratio of the private security personnel, for example, to public law enforcement is roughly 3 in the private sector, contrasted to 1 peace officer. That's a national standard, and Minnesota seems to be keeping pace with that same ratio. The sustained visibility of these services in our communities has brought about a reliance as well as that visibility. It brings about an assumed authority, potential for abuse of authority by people carrying out these services, and it can also bring about questions about use of force and protection of people's personal information in the services that they perform for their clients. These concerns are shared by the industry as they seek to have a more positive relationship both with the public and their clients as well as public law enforcement. In response to a strained budget outlook, the board is examining our enabling legislation and rules to look at ways to streamline processes without compromising the regulatory program. We're also open to looking at perhaps online capabilities that perhaps would expedite a process not only for us in terms of reduction of staff time carried out on certain functions, but also would be of benefit to the licensees. A 5% budget reduction has been recommended by the governor, and that is roughly $14,000 for the biennium, and that will directly impact our budget in the personnel area, and specifically reducing a 0.8 support staff position that we have to a 0.6. That's generally an overview of our operations and our activities, and I would be happy to respond to any questions that you might have about our program or other areas.
Thank you, Ms. Ullman. Questions? Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, I was trying to pay attention. How I see here what the general fund money is that supports it, but could you repeat for me how much money is raised from the fees that go into the general fund? Zoman?
Madam Chair, Senator Mao, let me just look at this reference material.
It's the same.
My apologies, Madam Chair, Senator Mao. The anticipated revenues would be $136,000 per years in the biennium.
Senator Mao.
So, Madam Chair, it almost about equals that the amount that they take out of the general fund is a little bit less than what they're able to generate. Madam Chair, was there ever any thought to dedicate the fees that were raised specifically to the organization?
You and I have been on this committee the same amount of time, I think. Yeah. So what happened before us, I don't know.
Was there any thought to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Mao?
Ms. Oma?
Some years ago, there was some conversation about dedicated funding, forgive the vernacular, but it was concluded that if you had a good year, you would be okay, but if you had a lean year, that would cause some difficulties for being able to carry out the program. But there was not a serious pursuit of that.
Ms. Oman, has there been wide fluctuations in the fees raised from year to year?
Madam Chair, the last time we changed fees was back in 2001, and it basically was a fairly substantial increase at that time, as we'd not raised our fees since about 1988, 1989, in that neighborhood. And basically, we were not carrying our water at that point, so we were basically in a position we really needed to substantially raise the fees to meet what our appropriation, the budget appropriation that we were seeking, so that that would coincide with what we were actually collecting.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I've been on 10 or 12 of the budget hearings for this agency, and it just doesn't, in my mind, merit much of a fight to maintain status quo or to change it in any way. I think the fees that the governor has proposed are adequate to do that, and unless you're contemplating putting funds from that account in something else in public safety, why I would recommend that no change be made.
Ms. Oman, how is the licensing work that you do different from the licensing work that Mr. Melton talked about in the post board?
Madam Chair, there is a unique difference in that post board does actually receive some funds from some other sources other than license fees. We also, in our program, we license the entity that provides the service. So whereas we only have several hundred license holders as opposed to post board that has several thousand, they also have a larger charge in terms of their connection with ensuring that certain training is being provided, their connections to the community college and other state college systems, and their responsibilities in that area. Whereas in, for instance, our training requirements, we approve the courses, but we don't provide them. So we are in the business of looking at the onus that we place on the license holders themselves to ensure certain things are accomplished in connection with, for instance, employees that they have that carry out the services that are provided. So it's a little bit different in terms of who is licensed, not only by profession, but what it is that's licensed as well.
Have you talked about sharing any resources between the two groups?
Madam Chair, we've not discussed sharing. No, that's not been a discussion that's occurred.
All righty. Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Members will be meeting again on Monday next week. We'll have Public Safety Department and Corrections on the agenda for Monday. And if there's nothing else before us, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.